Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me.
You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to...
Radio for Kansas.
You have to let it all go. Fear, doubt, and disbelief. Free your mind.
I turned on my TV, though it was hard to see these men who would be head of state. What a great country, from sea to shining sea, we watched the Republicans debate. New stood with his third wife and said, "You bet your life the president is a red. He wants to tax the rich a lot, take your limo and your yacht. He wants to have the banker's head. And if he gets in again, he'll be the White House pig, and then he'll hire Chavez as his VP. Then we'll be right on track to give capitalism the sack, along with the insurance industry. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. He'll give everyone food stamps and wheelchair ramps. He'll subsidize windmills and maple syrup. He'll cripple industries with eco-friendly policies, and pretty soon we will be just like Europe. He'll shut down oil wells, give out solar cells to every home in Delaware and Illinois. He'll ban logging in the parks. He'll send the works of Karl Marx to the homes of every American girl and boy. He'll abolish pesticides. He'll be giving out free rides and free lunches too in his high-speed train. He'll start lots of public works full of union perks. He'll fill all the cities up with bicycle lanes. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. Watch out, his critics tell, this shall be our death knell. He'll pull the truth out and end all of our wars. He'll gut military spending, our empire will be ending, and soon we'll be invaded by the Moors. He'll legalize all drugs, give away beer mugs and hookahs to every child and Koran. He'll ban religions from the schools, give 40 acres and a mule to every person who makes less than 50 grand. He'll close Guantanamo, to torture he'll say no. He'll make us all drive electric cars. He'll reinstate the fairness doctrine, take off that damn flag pin, and he'll put Rupert Murdoch behind bars. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you? If only it were true, if only it were true, if only it were true. If only it were true, if only it were true, I'd be so happy, wouldn't you?
David Robichs, David Robichs broadcasting somewhere out west, but he could be anywhere. He could be playing in Kansas. That's his latest from DaveRobichs.com and his latest album, his latest CD. I'm your host, Mike Adell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas. I've got some happy stuff for you tonight. Unfortunately, the Kansas State House is trying to put a dampen on our spirits by passing through the House today a law against payroll deductions for public employees. It's a onerous law, a sick law by some real weird people. But, you know, it passed only 60 to 54. That means that there's almost a little over half of, well, 54, even some Republicans opposed to that. That's a sign of hope out of the State House, and I do not give that, largely I don't give them much credit, but I'm giving them credit for that. I was impressed with that. Now, tonight we're going to have Free Speech Radio News, the latest from RH Reality Cast with Amanda Marcotte. We'll have put that on. And I'll read some of the local news. But first, let's do the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A Dutch court has ruled that Royal Dutch Shell can be held partially responsible for pollution in Nigeria's Niger Delta. The court also ordered the oil giant to pay damages to one farmer. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos.
Four Nigerians, backed by the environmental group Friends of the Earth, filed the suit in 2008 in The Hague, home of Shell's global headquarters. The lawsuit sought unspecified reparations for water and land contamination in the Niger Delta linked to Shell's oil operations there. In its judgment today, the court dismissed most of the allegations, but found the oil company responsible for one case of pollution. Human rights advocate Rosemary Okori tells FSRN that the case will encourage more claims related to the foreign activities of multinational companies.
With this verdict against Shell, a multinational, a lot many other things will begin to change. People who need to raise awareness about their problems will go a step further in bringing the requisite attention to their issues.
Critics say the judgment was mild. Shell had blamed saboteurs for the oil leaks, and the court sided with the company on four or five of the claims. Friends of the Earth has indicated it will appeal those rulings. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
The Zimbabwean Parliament is set to endorse a new draft constitution tomorrow. The document, which has been 3 years in the making, is expected to go to a nationwide referendum as early as March. If passed, national elections would follow later that year, potentially signaling the end of a continuing political crisis triggered by fraudulent elections in 2008. FSRN's Mishak Rusere reports from the capital, Harare.
Government leaders, including Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, are supporting the constitution, saying it will usher in a new era. Douglas Manzora is co-chair of the Constitution Select Committee.
We think it's a breakthrough. By going to the parliament tomorrow, we are happy as Zimbabweans because we know that if they go there, they are going to endorse the constitution making process, which has been the derailing factor all along.
The new constitution includes several controversial provisions, including presidential term limits and capping the power of the presidency, currently held by longtime leader Robert Mugabe. The new document also includes guarantees of press and political activity freedoms, but keeps a ban on same-sex marriage and upholds the death penalty. Misha Kruser, Harare.
The governor of Massachusetts has selected Mo Cowan to replace John Kerry in the U.S. Senate. Cowan was Governor Deval Patrick's chief of staff. He will hold the seat until a special election can be held this summer, but he says he does not intend to run in that race. Cowan's appointment means for the first time, two African Americans will be serving in the U.S. Senate concurrently. Climate change is already having a significant effect on wildlife populations in the U.S., and it's expected to get worse for many species. That's according to a new report out today from the National Wildlife Federation. Report author Amanda Stott says sometimes changing temperatures don't directly affect wildlife, but the indirect effects are just as severe. She cites the shifting range of the whitebark pine beetle.
What happens when you have these kind of infestations is that you have ripple down effects on other species within that ecosystem. And one example that we highlight in the report is grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park.
Stott says the grizzlies have fewer cubs when the whitebark pine nut supply is low, and there are more conflicts with humans as bears seek out new food sources. As wildlife ranges shift, the report recommends governments and individuals ensure animals have pathways to move into new habitats. Community groups in dozens of U.S. cities rallied today, calling for big corporations to pay a higher percentage of taxes. This comes as another budget showdown is brewing in Washington that could result in dramatic reductions in social service funding. From New York, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
Pay your taxes! Fix the debt!
About 50 people, including Karen Null, protested today in front of NBC's 30 Rock building, which is owned by General Electric.
We're here in front of GE today because CEO Jeffrey Immelt is on the board of a group called the Fix the Debt Campaign.
Fix the Debt is a lobbying group of about 90 corporate CEOs that back sequestration cuts. The cuts are mostly supported by Republicans and would severely reduce funding to social services like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
They want to fix the debt that they caused by taking away benefits from millions of hardworking Americans.
Florence Johnson is an advocate for New York Communities for Change.
And we're here to serve notice on them that they can fix the debt if they just pay their fair share in taxes.
Pay your share. Pay your share.
The protesters are demanding an end to corporate tax breaks. They say shift the burden to working people. Meanwhile, Congress has a March 1st deadline to agree on a deal to avoid sequestration cuts. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, New York.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thank you, Jess Burns. That's Free Speech Radio News headlines. What a surprise it is. You know, you got to be sort of careful when you enter into your child's bedroom sometimes. They might set you up for a real shocker. As happened to me just recently when I went into my 15-year-old son's bedroom, he was looking in to lurch. It's terrible when they get smart, isn't it? It's sort of like the state legislature in Topeka. When the state capital tries to get smart and scare the living daylights out of the population by passing this payroll deduction move. I'm totally opposed to that. I think it's ridiculous that they think that the unions are going to pay. A shout-out goes to Representative Peggy Mast for comparing our teachers' union to bullies. I think that was one of the most stupidest things that ever been said from the floor of the House in Topeka. I'll put up some local news before we get to our Amanda Marcotte's RH Reality Cast. And, of course, we've got to do something obstinate. Something needs to be obstinate after today's procedure. And here's some more news, courtesy Celia Lopi Jepson of the Topeka Capital Journal. There's a new bill targeting the union rights of all workers in the state of Kansas. A third bill on teachers' union has been introduced. This is the lead paragraph from her article on the today's January 30th Topeka Capital Journal. A third bill on teachers' unions has been introduced in the House Committee on Commerce that would go farther in restricting the rights of unions than the two previous bills. No hearing has been set yet for the, it's where, here, dig this, this is what it's called, Public Employee Freedom Act, House Bill, important number, House Bill number 2123, which would make collective bargaining optional for school boards and stop teachers from making any payments to unions through payroll deductions. The bill comes on the heels of HB 2023, which is what passed today, which the committee passed last week and which received initial approval in the House vote Wednesday. That's just, and HB 2085 currently under consideration in the committee. So this is just a slew of laws. I'm sure they were all written by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They were just a shotgun blast against the working people here in the state of Kansas. Again, as I said, I was surprised to see what few Republicans voted against this onslaught against working people. Actually, you know, there's a lot of Republicans who are cops and firefighters, professional cops, not elected cops. Those aren't real cops, folks. People, cops who are elected are not real cops. But the professionals who have these associations, there's a lot of state legislators who've been involved, either did that for a living or something. Ramon Gonzalez, I love that name. Representative Ramon Gonzalez from our county here in Jefferson County. I'm going to track him down and see what he voted on this thing. He is not an Alex Stooge. I can't believe it. You know, coming up this Saturday, an extended visit with a Republican, a smart conservative, about this very issue of public unions and just what is the State House up with Governor Brownback. Coming up this Saturday, high noon on Radio Free Kansas. Don't miss it. It's a great conversation. I recorded it, and I'm going to give it to you unedited, no commercials. And I don't chop it up. Because I want you to, you know, I'm going to dedicate more and more our legislature's in session talk about this House, the State House and the Senate, and most importantly, our dear leader, Governor Sam Brownback. First, some news. You know, this Friday, it will be February the 2nd. We will be having lots of things, as usual, happening in Kansas. Many, many good things happening in Kansas from the grassroots. You just don't know about it. And I just want you to be aware of it. Here we come up here as a reminder, this Saturday, let's see, the first Saturday of every month is a Bradley Manning vigil just outside the gates of Leavenworth Prison at 7th and Metropolitan at 1 p.m. Coming Saturday, there'll be another vigil out there, and I strongly encourage people who are interested in Private Bradley Manning, go there and attend and regroup with the people there, your kindred spirits. And let's see, what else? There's also the Lawrence Great Books Discussion Group. They're going to be holding their first Saturday of each month, that's this 2nd of February, from 2 to 4 p.m. They'll be meeting at the Old Borders Cafe in Lawrence, Kansas. Now, that's just off Massachusetts. They've closed down the public library for a short restoration project, and they're directing people's attention to the Old Borders Cafe. That's just right there. I mean, you just go over the bridge and going south into En Masse, get En Masse, and it's right there. Ask anybody. I'll have to look that address up for you. But it's at the Old Borders Cafe, 2 to 4 p.m. this coming Saturday, and they'll be discussing Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit this February. Join that book group if you like good talk with good people. I encourage you to check it out. Get there and visit with people. Let's see. What else is going on this Saturday? Well, you know, we've got all kinds of stuff happening in February. I'll get to that in just a minute. But let's you know, we're missing. Should I do this? Should I do it? Why not? We're missing who? Lee Camp. We're missing Lee Camp. And now close your ears, elders. Close your ears. Here's Everything Breaks. Moment of clarity.
We got no plans, no plans at all. Evil man's always transcending. Fight her like sheep, swallow everything. Always simpletons or pretending. We got no plans.
This is your moment of clarity from LeeCamp.net. Your possessions are designed to break. They're meant to implode and fail, explode into a hail of pieces in only a matter of weekends. Almost nothing you buy is meant to last more than a year or two, like a reality star created by MTV. 2 years and then it's so old, broken, or busted. Clothes are meant to fall apart or go out of fashion. Furniture breaks. Devices become outdated and are often not even compatible to older ones. There's nothing I hate more than when old technology isn't compatible with new technology. The other day I was trying to fax my carrier pigeon and it didn't work at all. He didn't fit. And then you got to buy the adapter and that's another $40. It's bullshit, all right? This shit, it should work. You can make it work for more than 2 weeks, you assholes. We know you can do it. The International Space Station has been going for 14 fucking years. But 3 months after I get a cell phone, it's on display in the Amish Museum of Antiquities. These products are meant to fall apart or go out of date. Economists call it planned obsolescence. But that's only because economists don't know how to speak to human beings, and at parties they're a real buzzkill because everyone's like, I'm getting fucked up tonight! And the economist goes, oh, you mean anticipated inebriation, and then no one sleeps with him. Anyway, when translated into human, planned obsolescence is shit be breaking. And shit be breaking because the companies make more money if shit be breaking than if shit be working. In the past, people made things to last because A, they cared about their customer, and B, they didn't want to have to build a new one. A beautiful hutch would get passed down from generation to generation, and 130 years after it was built, a child's mother would say to him, your great-great-grandfather built this with his bare hands, and your grandfather was born inside this hutch, and your father once fornicated with this hutch, and one day it'll be yours. You might want to wash it first. But nowadays, you buy something at IKEA, it's made out of cardboard, scotch tape, and wishes. 6 months later, it explodes into 1,000 pieces, and then the pieces become dust and blow away like a German dude at the end of an Indiana Jones movie. So we create piles and piles of trash, garbage the size of civilizations, and we're running out of places to put it. And then it washes into the ocean and becomes a flotilla the size of Texas in the Pacific. I'm not kidding, Google it. And whales have not yet evolved to consume plastic. I know, it's kind of lazy of them. We're doing our part, whales, by supplying you with all this sweet, delicious, homemade plastic. So why don't you do your part and fucking evolve to eat it? Or another option is maybe we could evolve as human beings. Help your friends realize we need a system that rewards the creation of products that last rather than punishes it. We have a limited amount of resources on this little rock, and I don't think we can just move to the plastic ocean patch when we're done with this land we're on. So let's get past our reticence and learn to reuse, recycle, rethink this system of planned obsolescence. Let's create furniture that lasts, computers that grow, and multi-purpose reality TV stars. Let's recycle Snooki and Donald Trump. Sure, maybe America doesn't want to hear what they have to say anymore, but perhaps we can feed them to the livestock. Let's do this before we're the ones who are obsolete. That's your moment of clarity from LeeCamp.net. If you'd like a free single track download from my new live comedy album that comes out this week entitled Pepper Spray the Tears Away, all you have to do is email your city to pepperspraythetearsaway@gmail.com. Just send that email and a single track from the album will be sent to you in response. Also, you can enter to win a copy of the full album by retweeting one of my tweets about the album. My Twitter name is @LeeCamp. Thanks.
Plans, no plans at all. Evil man's always transcending. Fight like sheep, swallow everything. Always simpletons or pretending.
LeeCamp, my man, the guy is just not. You know, you can't. What do you do with that? Oh, he has the clean version. Yes, he does. But, you know, we're on the internet. This isn't the FCC world. No, and it's not ran by some poor college kids that are just fresh hot to get out of the college in front of the television cameras. But I do got to hand it to Channel 13's Morning Squad with Amanda and Drew Schweitzer. I get a little upset with them at times, but I got to tell you, WIBW television in the morning, when it's, you know, knuckle down time, when the weather's bad, they kids do get their act together and read something beyond if it bleeds, it leads news. They actually do give you some pretty good weather. I was real fortunate to get the weather at 5 in the morning from that, and was sat around waiting, hoping that the school did not close. But unfortunately, the school closed. and I had a happy day with my family today. Here, snowbound on ice-packed or ice-covered, snow-packed public highways here in North Jefferson County. So we had a day together. We are manning the wood stoves, keeping the fires going here. And what better way to keep the fires going than to music, music by David Rovix. This one is also from his latest CD, and here it's called Watch Out for the Cops to the State Legislature.
Portland is a town that's in the news much of the time. There are a lot of vegans and there's very little crime. It's a nice, safe place to live. Folks ride bicycles a lot. The winters aren't so cold and the summers aren't so hot. They build houses out of cobs. They hang out in the park where you needn't worry about walking after dark. There are lots of homeless people, but they don't hurt no one. Just be careful of the boys in blue playing with their guns. Yeah, watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. You can hang out with the punks with the piercings and tattoos. You can eat out at a food truck any neighborhood you choose. You can dance to Balkan music while you drink a microbrew, chilling in a gay bar with the mayor and his crew. But be careful what you do. Be prepared to get some flack, especially for those who may be male, young, and black. The fact is you do better in Sweet Home, Alabama. You're safer there on the old streets of Birmingham. Yeah, watch out for the cops.
Prisons with some nice electric chairs. You can go downtown, ride the buses there for free, but you never know when you'll get a DWP. A town full of progressives, but such a rotten bunch of cops. Who knows who'll get shot at the next routine traffic stop? When you live in a place like Portland, where they tend to act this way, you can just join the police force instead of the KKK. Yeah, watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops. Watch out for the cops.
Dedicated to the state legislature that's so worried about cops. And by the way, you know cops are part of public employee associations. Yes. Well, we might be wanting to watch out for the cops because they have their unions too. Now, coming up, and by the way, every Tuesday from noon to 1 p.m., Occupy Wichita is outside the City Hall in Wichita opposed to all forms of police violence, most particularly the Wichita Police Department brutality. Every Tuesday at noon, you can go outside the south doors of the City Hall located at 3rd and Main and attend brothers and sisters vigiling against all forms of police violence. You know, no thanks to the State House on that. And we'll get back to some more local news there's some interesting things happening around Valentine's Day in the state, and it isn't a box of chocolates and a flower, I'll tell you that. Coming up, it's part of the OneBillionRising.org movement happening in both Kansas City and Topeka so far, and I'll get back with you on that as it develops here tonight on Radio Free Kansas. I'm real happy to have you listening. I hope you tell your friends about the show. Need all the ears and eyes we can get. Bring your news in. You know, do it all. Bring your news in, brothers and sisters.
Would you like your group announcement, or maybe you're holding a demonstration and would like it read on Radio Free Kansas? There's no charge for this service, and it gets out to a large audience of listeners in Kansas who can think for themselves. You and your friends don't have a corporate logo or brand name, but maybe want to manufacture dissent and democracy instead of conformity? Radio Free Kansas is the place to have your news announced to a large community in the reddest of all states, Kansas. Or as we've been calling it lately, Brownbackistan. The disappointing news is you might not get your news on Radio Free Kansas. Sorry. If you were a cheerleader for the last two bankrupting wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, go elsewhere. Or how about a paranoid gun rubber trying to get your buds to go camping, sitting along some Kansas creek by a campfire, planning some racist New World Order, won't get the next gun show announced on Radio Free Kansas either. How about 24% of the conservative voters who go to church regularly and believe President Obama is the Antichrist or a space alien without a birth certificate? Well, you can try. You believe in angels, demons, and magical miracles, don't you? Send it in. You never know. Or maybe you believe you do? If you think Kansans, smart Kansans, might be interested in coming to your event, go ahead and send it in. Feel free. It's free. Email to BlueBarnNewsCentral@gmail.com. That's BlueBarnNewsCentral@gmail.com. Please provide some contact information, such as an email address or a phone number. And thank you for listening to Radio Free Kansas.
Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinions, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be interviewing Deborah Hauser from Advocates for Youth about telling abortion stories. More in-depth reporting on the Violence Against Women Act, and NPR does a great job covering the Hobby Lobby contraception lawsuit. This week marks the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. I may have further coverage of how people mark this anniversary starting next week, but for now, a reminder of what abortion in America actually looks like, courtesy of Guttmacher.
Almost one out of every three American women will have an abortion by age 45. They come from all walks of life. They are women you know. Most women having abortions are in their 20s. Many people mistakenly believe that teens are the group most likely to have an abortion. Teens actually account for fewer than 2 in 10 of all abortions, and most of them are older teens, those aged 18 and 19. 6 in 10 women having abortions already have a child, and many have 2 or more. They know what it means to be a mother, and they often cite the need to care for their children as a primary reason for deciding not to have another right now.
It's a good video to keep in your pocket, as the debate will be hot this week, and it's important to remember that women having abortions don't conform to anti-choice stereotypes at all. I mentioned this briefly a couple of episodes ago, but now it's looking like it really, truly is a permanent state of affairs. The Violence Against Women Act, which first passed in 1994, is no longer. And not, as you might hope, because we licked that problem and don't need federal legislation addressing it any longer. I wish. No, it's because the House simply let the bill die out, and their excuse as to why is deeply pathetic.
Melissa, we've been talking about things that have gone unreported in the last couple weeks that are of great import. The fact that this bill, which has been in law, this has been in place for nearly 20 years, is being held up, and what the analysis says is largely due to the fact that Eric Cantor does not want to expand this provision to include Native American women. It is some staggering statistics from the Department of Justice. 34% of Native American women will be raped in their lifetime. 86% of perpetrators are non-Native.
Right.
This expansion would make perpetrators open to prosecution on tribal land.
Right.
To explain further, Eric Cantor's excuse is that he's suddenly and remarkably obsessed with maintaining rigid, arbitrary jurisdiction laws as they stand now, even if they're not working to actually achieve justice. The reason is because, and that's why. It certainly has nothing to do with a pattern of attacks on women at the behest of a far-right fringe that sees this legislation as undermining patriarchal power in the home. Perish the thought. It's because Cantor just believes that jurisdictional lines should never change, even as the lines of congressional districts should be endlessly manipulated for maximum electoral results. The fact that the right-wing media has been accusing feminists for decades of simply making up the problem of widespread rape and domestic violence so that we can create a boondoggle to enrich ourselves is just a remarkable coincidence, right? And now we're whining because we're all supposedly making millions off running domestic violence shelters and stuff like that. Certainly couldn't be because we care about victims of violence, because no one really cares about them, do they? Okay, angry sarcasm over, for now. Melissa Harris-Perry had a couple of things to say that are worth listening to.
This is the key. The issue is not so much that Native American women are not covered, but that on tribal lands, that there was not jurisdiction for tribes themselves if a non-Indian committed an act of violence against an Indian woman, right? So that's sort of the fundamental question.
Which erodes protection for Indian women.
Which erodes protection for Indian women in a critically important way. So literally, you could drag a victim over the line onto the reservation and, in fact, on tribal lands, commit an assault against her and potentially be free from jurisdictional problems. So this is critical. And here's the other important part. The congresswoman who, in fact, penned this piece of legislation lost her primary. So in order for the House version to be renewed, so a whole new congressperson is going to have to bring this back up. So we're talking about more than a decade of work on the part of indigenous women to move this through. Died because 112 under Eric Cantor, as well as John Boehner, just made a decision not to bring this to the vote.
So they didn't just kill the bill, they super killed the bill. I'm sure that some would simply say it's an accident and that they didn't want it to turn out this way. But it's interesting that the second that they had an opportunity to destroy a piece of legislation that was a signature bill for the sitting vice president, and that the right-wing press has been complaining about ever since the past, well, they took it. And they took an opportunity that makes it much harder to get any bill like it passed ever again. So what does the Violence Against Women Act do? A number of things, including providing resources for women trying to escape abusive relationships and training law enforcement to handle rape and domestic violence cases more effectively. Since it passed, the rate of domestic violence has declined pretty dramatically, so the loss of this legislation is worrisome. Brown University professor Tricia Rose was on Current TV talking about the classism and racism of the excuse to kill the legislation.
Well, I mean, we've always known that all groups of women are not equal in American history, and all groups of people have not been equal. So when we say a war on women, we mean all women, but we mean vulnerable women,
sure.
Poor women, people of color, immigrants, Native Americans who were here first, lest we need to remind the American people that their lands were stolen, but they're all the most vulnerable. So what this is about really is separating women who have the privilege to get abortions elsewhere, right? This is the same thing that you mentioned before, to have other kinds of reproductive freedoms from those who don't, and to make sure that those at the bottom scratch and fight to survive. It's appalling.
It's critical that people see the connections between the hostility towards VAWA and the increasing restrictions on reproductive rights. Both disproportionately hurt poorer women, younger women, and women of color, and that's not an accident. That's the point. Obviously, it's not like people who support these anti-feminist policies have much love for any women, But the levels of contempt and hostility go up dramatically when it comes to those who aren't already privileged. We are increasingly becoming the country of the have and have-nots when it comes to women's basic human rights, where women who have money and social privilege can get reproductive health care and even legal help escaping abusive relationships, and women who don't have those things are out of luck. I'd like to welcome Deborah Hauser to the program. Deborah is the Executive Director of Advocates for Youth, an organization that works to improve sexual health outcomes and sexual autonomy for young people. She's here to talk about their 1 in 3 campaign focused on storytelling about abortion. Welcome to RealityCast, Deborah.
Thanks, Amanda.
So you guys have been running the 1 in 3 campaign for a while, but now you have a book coming out. Can you tell me about this campaign and this book?
Sure. The 1 in 3 campaign is an effort to create a new cultural narrative around abortion. The staff here at Advocates, we haven't done a lot around abortion prior to this because a lot of the work we do is really focused on young people. And, quite frankly, it was a space where abortion activists were chipping away, but it's hard to have young people in the forefront because it's a bit of an Achilles heel. And yet, we were sitting around and just really frustrated over all of the anti-abortion legislation that had been introduced into state legislatures that year. And we thought, what is a contribution that we can make? And a conversation ensued, and staff here, range from 22 to 70, so it's a big range of different ages. And we realized that the young staff was saying that they really don't know a lot of the pre-rare stories and that people don't really talk about their abortion experiences. And once we started to have a conversation about that, we realized that so much of the debate around abortion, especially coming from those who support abortion access, is legal and policy work. It's the debate is so polarizing. And yet, what we really wanted to do is create a much more affective, put the woman back in the middle of the story. And that this is, 1 in 3 women in their lifetime face the situation of trying to decide about an abortion. Actually, more, 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in her lifetime. And so this is a fairly common experience, and yet the staff was saying, nobody talks about it. Nobody talks about their experience. And so how do we know who these stories and what the complexities of these stories? And one young woman on staff began to tell her own story, and that made me tell my story. And what I've noticed since then is as we're telling our stories or writing our stories or people are reading these stories, that when you begin to talk about your own story, other people share theirs. And what happens is we realize that we have a lot in common. Our experiences are all different. But so much of the feeling and the complexity of the decision and the relief or the sense of, years later, I look back and I've been able to create the family that I want. There is such a bond that keeps us together. And once I broke and told my own story at that point, it became much easier to tell it again and again and to be more vocal about supporting abortion access. So that's what the campaign is about. It's really about helping women who want to. Nobody's ever, asked who that doesn't want to, but if women want to share their stories, giving them a platform to do that in a public way, either on the website or on through a video, written or in some format, and then getting that out to women across college campuses. We have young people who are active on campus that are using these stories to help share them, to have a dialogue about them, to shift the conversation so that we're building empathy and support and giving young women the voice to be supportive of abortion access once they read the stories. And then we're also getting it out online through social media and Twitter. There's a Tumblr. So it's been really exciting. And we've gathered about a little under 200 stories to date. And I've been amazed at the power of them. And they range from women who were pre-Roe all the way through to, this year.
So now you guys have a book. You took about 40 of the stories from the 200 or so that you've collected. Why did you pick the 40 stories that you did?
The stories are somewhat randomly selected. We wanted 40 stories to recognize the 40-year anniversary of Roe, we didn't select them because they were better or worse than any others. We really went back out. We wanted to make sure we had permission to use them in this sort of sense of sort of ethical story sharing, making sure we had permission to put them up on the website. Everyone submitted their story directly to the campaign, but we wanted to go back out and ask permission again to say, can we use them for this book? And so really it was the first 40 or 42 stories actually that we got permission to use. For the we chose 40 of those and put them in the book. And they really just represent the incredible breadth and diversity of women's experiences with this issue, but also when you read them, this theme of family and responsibility and, you know, trying to do the right thing. And it runs through it. It's so interesting. There's so many diverse experiences, and yet there's this theme that's common through them as well. It really shows, you know, that abortion has been common through the generations, and that in all instances, women are doing their best. And, you know, sometimes that's a really hard choice, and sometimes it's what they always knew they would do if it came to this. But in a lot of cases, what you see is that it's a story of family. And so many of the women wrote that, you know, they weren't ready at the time, or they had a bad situation, or there was a problem physically or emotionally. And yet when they look back, they're so grateful for the ability to have had the abortion, because now they were in a better situation. They've since had other children. They've, you know, some of them talked about their grandchildren. And it was really heartwarming to read the stories and how powerful they were.
I can safely say that every time I've ever told someone who didn't know that one in three women will have an abortion in her lifetime, they're genuinely shocked, you know, that that's so many. Why is it that people don't know this?
Well, if we don't ever talk about it, you know, I mean, this is the very essence of the campaign, is that when we tell our stories or share our stories with each other, and you realize how common, I've never been in a room since I started doing this a couple years ago, I've not been in a room where I've shared my story and someone else, at least one person in that room, hasn't also shared theirs. And so you begin to get the sense that this is way more common than I might have expected before. During the period, you know, I had my abortion many years ago, and really didn't talk about it, you know, in between then and now, almost ever. And so, you know, at other points in my life, you'd look around a room and you don't know, you don't have any sense who else in this room, or if I bring this up, will other people like look at me or make judgments or feel funny? And so what was really freeing about telling my story, and that I've heard from the other women who are telling theirs, is that it takes that away from you, because as soon as you tell it, other people tell theirs, and then you feel this sisterhood and camaraderie, and you begin to realize one in three is. Abortion has been and will continue to be a common experience across the generations for women, and then the question becomes, are we going to be empathetic to women's, you know, lives and their complexity, and really allow them to make the decisions with their families and their physicians and keep abortion safe and legal? It just puts it in a very different perspective.
So Roe versus Wade was decided on the grounds of privacy, that you have a right to your privacy. And I think a lot of women really think of abortion in those terms of like privacy, and it's a private decision and not something you talk about very much. With that in mind, how does one think about this kind of storytelling in that context? Like, what relationship do you see between the need to be private and the need to tell our stories?
I think every woman has to make the decision, you know, who she wants to share her story with, if anyone. And this is a private decision that a woman should make with her family, with her physician. And whether she shares that then with her the rest of her family, whether she tells her daughters or her granddaughters, or whether she shares it with her sisters or colleagues, is her choice. But what we do know, and we've seen from other storytelling movements, is that when you do share it, a personal story, this is what happened to me, and when women hear multiple stories and they realize, you know, that it happens in various ways and to many different women, it breaks through some of the mythology and the stigma, and just makes it easier for women to have had the experience and to live with the experience. It's not so the stigma makes you feel very isolated. So no one should ever tell their story that doesn't want to. But we should also not have to live in fear that we'll be either targeted by anti-abortion rhetoric or violence because we've chosen to have abortion or we choose to share our stories. Neither thing is okay.
My guest today has been Deborah Hauser of Advocates for Youth. If you want to learn more about the 1 in 3 campaign and buy the book, please visit 1in3campaign.org. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Deborah.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It finally happened. NPR did a report on the battle over the contraception mandate, and they did so without being ensnared by the bad faith arguments being offered by conservatives, pretending that this is about anything but their attempts to reduce women's access to contraception. This is exciting stuff because NPR is usually so paranoid about being accused of a liberal bias that they often let, you know, the facts fall by the wayside. But in the case of Hobby Lobby's war against paying their employees their earned benefits, NPR did a really good job. A quick summary of the case for those who haven't been following.
David Green is the founder and CEO of Hobby Lobby, an arts and crafts chain with 500 stores in 41 states and more than 22,000 employees.
Hobby Lobby has always been a tool for the Lord's work. For me and my family, charity equals ministry, which equals the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Green said on a conference call last fall that he's always run his company in accordance with his Christian faith. His stores are not open on Sunday, and the company contributes time and funds to Christian organizations, both in the U.S. and internationally. But he says the contraceptive requirement directly challenges that faith.
And our family is now being forced to choose between following the laws of the land that we love or maintaining the religious beliefs that have made our business successful and have supported our family and thousands of our employees and their families.
What's nice is that NPR did not give Green airtime to promote the false claim that the contraception mandate covers abortion. Green has been making this claim at every opportunity, but it's simply not true. He rationalizes this lie by claiming to believe that hormonal contraception, especially emergency contraception, is abortion. But the problem with that is just because you believe a lie doesn't mean it's not a lie. NPR needs to quote people from all sides of the story, of course. But if they're not going to fact-check their lies on air, they need to at least avoid giving those lies airtime, which they did, so that's very good. They also let the ACLU, you know, the preeminent defenders of actual First Amendment rights in this country, come on to explain why giving employers a right to impose their faith on employees is exactly the opposite of religious liberty.
But as Bridget Amiri of the ACLU points out, only one of those cases so far has resulted in a decision on the religious discrimination arguments.
And the court in that case held that the case should be dismissed because the plaintiff could not show that its religious liberty would be violated by the rule.
Amiri says she's hopeful and optimistic that in the end, backers of the contraceptive coverage requirement will prevail, at least in the case of the private companies that are suing.
Once you enter the public sphere, and particularly when you operate a for-profit company, you can't impose your religious beliefs on your employees.
And she says there's plenty of court precedent to back that up.
The courts have routinely held that employers that have a religious objection, for example, to paying their female and male employees equally based on beliefs that the Bible says that men should be head of household, they still have to comply with federal law that says that you have to treat your male and female employees equally.
And that's just what this is all about, paying women fairly under federal law. Hobby Lobby isn't suing to say that they should get to single out male employees and prevent them from getting their federally mandated preventive care coverage. And yes, there are some things that are for men especially that are mandated in the list of covered services, though you wouldn't know it from the hyper-focus on contraception in the media. But the funniest part of this segment, For My Money, is the desperate attempt from the conservative group American Center for Law and Justice to cast around for an excuse for why companies should meet minimum standards for health care coverage for their employees.
In other words, he says, the government might have other options to ensure that women get no-cost contraception.
For instance, we already have massive government programs that provide contraceptives for free.
Mannion says one possibility would simply be to make that program universal rather than limit it to people with low incomes. But that would likely raise the same fight that currently goes on over abortion, about whether people who object to something want their tax dollars used to pay for it.
Yep. You just heard a conservative lawyer reference the potential for a universal single-payer program for contraception. Good on NPR for calling out the extreme bad faith of this argument, coming from someone whose organization wouldn't hesitate to throw up every legal challenge possible to the government pushing for any kind of single-payer health care. In fact, a lot of the right-wing media, trying to drum up outrage about the contraception mandate, has called it taxpayer-funded, even though it's actually an argument about whether or not women can spend their own earned benefits on contraception. Now you have the lawyers, who are just throwing up legal arguments in order to win this case, suggesting a preferable alternative would be taxpayer-funded contraception. I mean, I agree. Single-payer in general would be better than a hodgepodge of insurance plans tied to your employment. But they don't mean that, and are just looking for any legal argument they can cling to. But their supporters may not know that it's pure bad faith and could freak out on them. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts, Rush Limbaugh trots out transphobia edition. Limbaugh is so afraid of transgendered men that he's taken to calling them addictomy babes.
That's what's revolutionary here. The addictomy babe wants to stay on camp.
He thought it was so funny that he kept using it over and over again. He seemed grumpy that the student in question's name isn't available to the public, but with people like him out there being so nasty, is it any wonder?
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January 30th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the U.S. Senate considers proposals to reduce gun violence in its first hearing since the Newtown school shooting. Parents and students from public schools across the U.S. converge in Washington, D.C. to demand a halt to school closings. They say the closures target students of color and disrupt communities. And why did a hearing at the Guantanamo Military Commission suddenly go dark? We'll hear from Truth Out's Jason Leopold at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to find out what happened. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A Dutch court has ruled that Royal Dutch Shell can be held partially responsible for pollution in Nigeria's Niger Delta. The court also ordered the oil giant to pay damages to one farmer. FSRN Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos.
Four Nigerians, backed by the environmental group Friends of the Earth, filed the suit in 2008 in The Hague, home of Shell's global headquarters. The lawsuit sought unspecified reparations for water and land contamination in the Niger Delta, linked to Shell's oil operations there. In its judgment today, the court dismissed most of the allegations, but found the oil company responsible for one case of pollution. Human rights advocate Rosemary Okori tells FSRN that the case will encourage more claims related to the foreign activities of multinational companies.
With this verdict against Shell, a multinational, a lot many other things will begin to change. People who need to raise awareness about their problems will go a step further in bringing the requisite attention to their issues.
Critics say the judgment was mild. Shell had blamed saboteurs for the oil leaks, and the court sided with the company on four or five of the claims. Friends of the Earth has indicated it will appeal those rulings. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
The Zimbabwean parliament is set to endorse a new draft constitution tomorrow. The document, which has been 3 years in the making, is expected to go to a nationwide referendum as early as March. If passed, national elections would follow later that year, potentially signaling the end of a continuing political crisis triggered by fraudulent elections in 2008. FSRN's Meshack Rusere reports from the capital, Harare.
Government leaders, including Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, are supporting the constitution, saying it will usher in a new era. Douglas Manzora is co-chair of the Constitution Select Committee.
We think it's a breakthrough. By going to the parliament tomorrow, we are happy Zimbabweans because we know that if they go there, they are going to endorse the constitution making process, which has been the derailing factor all along.
The new constitution includes several controversial provisions, including presidential term limits and capping the power of the presidency, currently held by longtime leader Robert Mugabe. The new document also includes guarantees of press and political activity freedoms, but keeps a ban on same-sex marriage and upholds the death penalty. Misha Kruser, Harare.
The governor of Massachusetts has selected Mo Cowan to replace John Kerry in the U.S. Senate. Cowan was Governor Deval Patrick's chief of staff. He will hold the seat until a special election can be held this summer, but he says he does not intend to run in that race. Cowan's appointment means for the first time, two African Americans will be serving in the U.S. Senate concurrently. Climate change is already having a significant effect on wildlife populations in the U.S., and it's expected to get worse for many species. That's according to a new report out today from the National Wildlife Federation. Report author Amanda Stott says sometimes changing temperatures don't directly affect wildlife, but the indirect effects are just as severe. She cites the shifting range of the whitebark pine beetle.
What happens when you have these kind of infestations is that you have ripple-down effects on other species within that ecosystem. And one example that we highlight in the report is grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park.
Stott says the grizzlies have fewer cubs when the whitebark pine nut supply is low, and there are more conflicts with humans as bears seek out new food sources. As wildlife ranges shift, the report recommends governments and individuals ensure animals have pathways to move into new habitats. Community groups in dozens of U.S. cities rallied today, calling for big corporations to pay a higher percentage of taxes. This comes as another budget showdown is brewing in Washington that could result in dramatic reductions in social service funding. From New York, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
Pay your taxes! Ditch the debt!
About 50 people, including Karen Null, protested today in front of NBC's 30 Rock building, which is owned by General Electric.
We're here in front of GE today because CEO Jeffrey Immelt is on the board of a group called the Fix the Debt Campaign.
Fix the Debt is a lobbying group of about 90 corporate CEOs that back sequestration cuts. The cuts are mostly supported by Republicans and would severely reduce funding to social services like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
They want to fix the debt that they caused by taking away benefits from millions of hardworking Americans.
Florence Johnson is an advocate for New York Communities for Change.
And we're here to serve notice on them that they can fix the debt if they just pay their fair share in taxes.
Pay your share. Pay your share.
The protesters are demanding an end to corporate tax breaks. They say shift the burden to working people. Meanwhile, Congress has a March 1st deadline to agree on a deal to avoid sequestration cuts. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, New York.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Senate held its first hearing since the Newtown school shooting on proposals to stem gun violence. Lawmakers debated stricter background checks, bans on certain kinds of weapons and ammunition, and plans to arm more citizens. This week's shootings on a school bus in Alabama and near a school in Chicago claimed more lives, and another shooting in Arizona injured more during the Senate hearing. Yet the lawmakers on the Judiciary Committee and the expert witnesses failed to agree today on a path forward. One key Democrat plans to hold her own hearings in the coming weeks. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Three of the five witnesses at Wednesday's hearing told senators that the government shouldn't enact any new gun control measures. because people need assault weapons and large clips of ammunition for self-defense. National Rifle Association CEO Wayne LaPierre added that those people shouldn't have to go through the bureaucracy of background checks at gun shows. Baltimore Police Chief James Johnson called this argument insane.
It's not an inconvenience. The record shows that nearly 92% of the individuals that go in to try to do a background check at a gun shop, in a minute and a half, they're done. I can't write a citation that fast.
Johnson voiced support for stronger background checks and the new assault weapons ban introduced by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein earlier this month. While Feinstein agreed with the pro-gun witnesses and lawmakers at the hearing that mental health issues and violent media culture should also be addressed, she said the NRA's LaPierre is wrong for opposing any restrictions on gun ownership.
He makes his claim that everybody is entitled to these weapons. My view is everybody is entitled to be safe and go to a movie without a threat of getting mowed down. The NRA says guns don't kill people. People kill people. Well, they're always going to be people, no matter what you do.
Yet the other witnesses at Wednesday's hearing, David Koppel with the Libertarian Cato Institute and Gail Trotter with the Pro-Gun Independent Women's Forum, testified that having more guns in schools and homes would better protect children and families. And the Republican senators on the committee, who all have A ratings from the NRA, agreed. One of them, Iowa's Chuck Grassley, said the proposed assault weapons ban and the president's recent campaign to address gun violence could, quote, lead to tyrannical federal government.
This necessarily and understandably leads many citizens to fear that their individual rights will be violated. It should be a matter of deep concern to all of us.
The NRA's PAC spent more than $55,000 to help Grassley win re-election in 2010, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. He's just one of 11 members of the committee to receive major donations from the organization. The political and economic power of the NRA and other gun lobby groups prompted former Congress member and gun violence survivor Gabrielle Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly to form their own PAC last year, called Americans for Responsible Solutions. They plan to help elect politicians who support gun control measures. Giffords, who was shot with an assault rifle in early 2011 and still suffers from mental and physical disabilities, gave a short statement at Wednesday's hearing.
Speaking is difficult, but I need to say something important. Violence is a big problem. Too many children are dying. Too many children. We must do something. It will be hard, but the time is now. You must act.
Later in the nearly four-hour-long hearing, Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin said the story of 15-year-old Hadiyah Pendleton, who was shot and killed Tuesday in Chicago, should spur lawmakers to quickly pass gun control legislation. Senator Feinstein plans to hold her own hearings on her assault weapons ban bill and other gun control measures in the coming weeks. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
Public school parents and students from 18 cities across the country gathered in Washington, D.C. this week to demand a nationwide moratorium on school closings. They argue that schools are often closed without public input, and that harms students and disrupts entire communities. Critics say most school closings target communities of color, which makes them a violation of their civil rights. FSRN's Jessel Knorr reports.
Federal programs like Race to the Top offered financial incentives for cities and states for radically changing their schools, including firing staff and shutting schools down. While the Obama administration touted the competitive multi-billion-dollar program as a way to improve education and better prepare students for college and the workforce, many parents, students, and teachers say the changes are disproportionately affecting low-income communities of color.
I came here to demand. I ain't asking for not a damn thing. I'm telling you that demanding an education for our children. We pay the money. We send our children to the schools. They are our schools. They are our children. It is our money. And that's my attitude over all these years.
That's Helen Moore, a longtime civil rights leader and Detroit education activist. She is one of hundreds who attended a hearing Tuesday in Washington, D.C., calling for a national moratorium on school closings. Moore was part of a group that filed a Title VI civil rights complaint last summer, challenging the policies. She says school closings in Detroit, a city already marked by high rates of unemployment, vacant houses, and foreclosures, are destabilizing the community.
Neighborhoods start going down as the families move out. They don't want to be told which school they have to go to because there's no other choice for them to go to.
When a school is closed, the student population often has to travel to a different school building or reapply to go back to their school. Additionally, the staff is often replaced and resources are regularly cut, sometimes in favor of a charter school that is opened in the same building. Seth Galanter is with the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. He said they are investigating people's concerns and the six Title VI complaints that were filed.
The question we're asking when we go to these communities is whether a school district made its decision with the intent to discriminate or whether the decisions have illegal discriminatory effects on students of color. In investigating these complaints, we're not only going to examine the decision to close schools, but the decision about which schools to close, where the students are being reassigned from these closed schools, how these decisions are being implemented, and the effects on the students.
After the hearing, hundreds of parents and students marched to the Martin Luther King Memorial for a rally, continuing their call for justice. Joel Velasquez, a parent from Oakland, California, says he fought plans to shut his son's school by leading a three-week-long sit-in at Lakeview Elementary.
Well, after a year of, you know, trying to meet with our local officials and superintendent and our board members, we were left with no option, and we actually took back our school on the last day of the school year, on June 13, 2012.
A delegation from New Orleans, the city with the highest proportion of charter schools in the country, also traveled to D.C. Student Terrell Major says his public school gets less resources than the charter school that shares the same building.
Like when the storm Isaac came, after we came back from the storm, this side of the cafeteria, because we sit on separate sides of the cafeteria, their side of the cafeteria was fixed up immediately, and our side was left damaged for weeks.
How did that make you feel?
Made me feel like I was lesser than. Almost as if I was, like, not relevant, like I didn't really matter in my own school.
Major calls that discrimination. Despite the challenges, some are encouraged by the growing grassroots movement against school closings, including New Orleans parent and activist Karen Harper Royal.
I think we are at a turning point because there are people organizing in different ways all over the country. In Seattle, it's around testing. We're organizing around school closures. There are teachers who are organizing around their evaluation system. There are different grassroots groups of people who are organizing around many different facets of what is being called education reform. We are definitely at a critical point because, after all, we're not getting the desired outcome.
Keep on talking, marching up the freedom.
One more time.
Let nobody.
In addition to a nationwide moratorium on school closings, activists are calling for sustainable school transformation, increased resources, and a community-based input process. Organizers have vowed to return to Washington if the Department of Education does not take action. Jessel Noor, FSRN, Washington.
Myanmar's armed forces have intensified attacks against the ethnic Kachin rebels near the border with China. The military for the country, also known as Burma, stepped up attacks just miles from the headquartered township of Lhasa, despite calls for a ceasefire. As FSRN's Ron Corbin reports, the escalation in the fighting has raised fears by humanitarian organizations about the welfare of thousands of internally displaced people as the government pushes to end the Kachin armed resistance.
Helicopter gunships backed up to 3,000 Myanmar troops pounded a key outlook held by the Kachin Independence Army in northern Myanmar, also known as Burma. video footage obtained by Irrawaddy News magazine, rebel soldiers attempted to fight back, firing mortars at the Myanmar troop position. Fighting around the Kar Yabum hilltop outpost has intensified over recent weeks as Myanmar's army has gradually gained ground against the Kachin army, despite a reported ceasefire being in place by President Thein Sein. After heavy shelling late last week, Kachin forces retreated from Kar Yabum, the last offensive outpost near the township and Kachin headquarters of Laysa. The fighting has escalated since Christmas Day, when the Myanmar army began using Russian-made helicopter gunships, referred to as flying tanks, attacking ethnic political resistance forces. Corinne Dean is a specialist researcher on the Kachin at the Tallinn University in Estonia. She says as the conflict escalates, the Kachin Independence Organization, or KIO, may be facing a critical moment in the five-decade struggle for autonomy.
Of course, the government has power and equipment, is well equipped to perhaps take over Laysa and crush them Kachin positions, but it will not be able to stop the violence. The KIO maybe have another tactic underground. I mean, it cannot really crush the resistance. There will be political resistance.
A 17-year-long ceasefire between the previous military government and Kachin forces broke down in mid-2011. Tensions had been rising after the Kachin refused to act as border guards and the Kachin political parties were refused registration by the government. In 2010 national elections, the government ruled out voting in Kachin state due to what it termed security reasons. The Kachin, along with other ethnic communities, have been calling for greater autonomy under the present constitution. The loss of Kar Yabum outpost is a major blow for the Kachin, whose troops were forced to retreat. A Kachin spokesperson, Colonel James Lumdur, claimed in a statement to FSRN that Kachin forces had retaken the outpost late Saturday. The claim could not be independently verified. He also repeated recent accusations of Myanmar troops using chemical weapons. The claim has been denied by the Myanmar government. A defence analyst at Australia's University of New South Wales, Carl Thayer, says Myanmar's army is pressing for a new ceasefire with the Kachin forces.
You know, the strategy, well, one, I mean, it's obviously to gain an upper hand. If the momentum is swinging and they can push and seize the capital, then the ceasefire comes and they have it in place. They're there. The attempt to get a ceasefire would cause the military to push even harder because it would solidify the gains it's got on the ground.
But others, including Tallinn University's Dr. Dean, says the outlook for the Kachin would be bleak under a new ceasefire.
Currently, during the ceasefire, the KIO has been controlling areas near the border that in some ways has provided the Kachin community survival and security to them and also autonomy to pursue various grassroots projects, education, and particularly education. Because in KIO-controlled areas, Kachin language higher education, it is the only place where Kachin language higher education has been provided.
For rights and humanitarian groups, the fighting has led to increased concerns over tens of thousands of internally displaced people. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs spokesperson in Yangon, Stuart Davies, says international organizations are calling for access to conflict areas to assess the needs of civilians.
More than ever now, we're concerned about civilians caught in this conflict, and really we're trying to reiterate that we've got a concern for 75,000 people already and have been since June of last year. So, you know, our key message is we continue to advocate the government to get access. We need access first, and then we can follow up a lot.
Some analysts say Myanmar's government is seeking to extend control over a region rich in resources. Several countries, including the United States and the United Nations, have raised concerns over the rising violence. But Myanmar state-controlled media challenged the criticism, accusing the Kachin of terrorist actions and atrocities. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
This week, Ali Sheikh Mohammed and four other defendants accused of planning the September 11th terrorist attacks are facing a pretrial hearing at the Guantanamo Bay Military Commissions. At issue are a number of motions, including access to evidence and classified information, and whether the torture of defendants while in U.S. custody at CIA black sites can be part of the trial. The proceedings were interrupted at one point this week when the audio and video feed was suddenly blacked out after one of the defense attorneys began discussing the CIA black sites. Reporter Jason Leopold was there, and he joins us on the line from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where he's been monitoring the hearing this week for Truthout. The quality of the line is patchy, but we're going to do our best. Jason, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you so much for having me on.
This week, the defense has been working through a number of motions in this pretrial hearing. What has been the subject of some of those this week?
Well, most of the motions that we're hearing this week, or what we have heard since Monday, they're really, really technical legal motions. Much of it has to do with the sharing of information, classified information. The defense also wanted to have access to the high-value prisoner camp, which is known as Camp 7, which is where all of the high-value detainees, prisoners, are held. There's 14 of them, obviously five on trial here, and they want to have access to it and spend 48 hours at that camp in order to see the conditions in which they're, which the accused are living under.
And has Judge Pohl ruled on that motion?
He hasn't. What's at issue with regard to that motion is how lengthy will be, the defense will have access to it. So, for example, the defense wants to spend 2 days, 48 hours, at these camps, literally sort of living in the shoes of their clients to see what the conditions are. Whereas the prosecution is saying, look, that's too much time. How are we going to handle, classified information? Who can they speak to? We don't want them speaking to any random guards. It's such a secure facility that the defense teams are not, or rather the prosecution is not open to having them there at that amount of time. So this is something that the judge is trying to work out.
Talk about what happened Monday. There was a 3-minute period in the proceedings when the audio and video was blacked out. The military judge, James Pohl, at the time appeared not to understand why. What happened?
In this courtroom, just to sort of describe it to you, I also need to note here that, since I'm speaking to you, from Guantanamo on a phone, at Guantanamo, all of our discussions are being monitored. So the sticker on the phone that actually states that explicitly. But, one of the issues that, popped up on Monday was the use of what's known as a sensor button. It basically, to prevent classified information from being discussed in open court, the judge and the court security officer, they have access to, they just hit a button. And when they hit that button, it triggers a red flashing light on the judge's, on his bench. And, it sort of looks like a siren. And the defense attorney for Khaled Sheikh Mohammed, David Nevin, he was discussing issues related to the CIA black site detention facilities where KSM was being held. And as soon as he went into that discussion, as soon as he actually said the word secret, this red flashing light went on, and we, the media and other observers, were sitting in the gallery in the courtroom, and it's separated by thick soundproof glass, and it's already on a 40-second delay. The audio feed to the closed circuit television, which we follow, it went dead. There was white noise. The feed was killed, and when they returned 3 minutes later, the judge had no idea who hit this button.
So as you describe it, there is this 40-second delay already with audio and video. During this blackout, the military judge appeared not to understand why. You said the prosecutors did appear to understand why. Did the attorneys for the defendants understand why this was taking place?
No, and they made it very clear that they had no idea, you know, that this was being used. It was sort of this revelation, even though many had suspected it, that the CIA is also monitoring these proceedings and seems to have control over this button, which the judge appeared to be surprised about, although the prosecution says he was already well aware.
And Jason Leopold, very quickly, the hearings continue this week. What's next?
Well, actually, you know, the hearings were supposed to be all week, meaning Monday through Thursday, 28th through the 31st. So today, Wednesday, there is actually a day off for us, for the media and the NGOs that are here observing as well, because what is there are motions that are being discussed in closed court. So there's a closed session. It's going to pick up again sometime next week. In fact, next week there will also be the al-Nashiri case that he is the alleged mastermind behind the USS Cole. So that will pick up next week here, and then following that, also in February, the KSM hearings will continue.
Jason Leopold, lead investigator reporter with Truth Out, joined us from Guantanamo Bay, where he's covering the hearing this week. Jason Leopold, thank you very much for joining us.
I appreciate you having me on.
And you can follow Jason's work at truthout.org. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kamp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace and author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, who talks about the dangerous consequences provoked by the U.S. drone warfare program. Dylan Voorhees of the Natural Resources Council of Maine, who explains why protesters will be gathering in Portland on January 26th to oppose plans to pump tar sands oil via an existing pipeline from Canada to New England states. And Tim Sullivan, policy coordinator with United for a Fair Economy, who discusses his group's just-released report titled State of the Dream 2013, A Long Way from Home. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
French military intervention to stop the advance of al-Qaeda-linked militants in the African nation of Mali led to a new crisis in January as Islamic militants in neighboring Algeria retaliated by seizing foreign hostages at a large natural gas facility. A raid by the Algerian military on the complex led to the death of 37 foreign captives and 29 extremists. Since a military coup in Mali last spring, the West African country has seen Tuareg separatists and Islamic militias take control of the northern half of the country. Islamic fighters linked to al-Qaeda set up a harsh form of Sharia law and opened training camps attracting foreign militants. In December, the United Nations Security Council approved an African-led fighting force to intervene in Mali, but no action was planned to take place until this fall. French President François Hollande declared his nation had to act as Islamic forces launched an offensive and took over several towns 200 miles from Mali's capital city of Bamako. African troops from Nigeria and Togo arrived to help the French, which ruled Mali until 1960, while troops from Chad, Niger, and Burkina Faso are expected to arrive soon. In response to the crisis, the Obama White House ramped up counter-terror activities in northern Africa, including the launch of drone strikes and mobilization of special operations teams against al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. In the bustling city of Accra, the capital of Ghana, the five-star Movenpick Hotel opened in 2011, backed by money from Saudi Arabia. The hotel offers 260 luxury rooms with thousands of square feet of high-end retail stores. Among the investors in the Accra Hotel complex was the World Bank's private investment arm, the International Finance Corporation, or IFC, whose mission is to provide affordable loans in the developing world. Many critics are wondering what the IFC was doing, bankrolling a $26 million loan to a luxury hotel investment company owned by Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, who has a net worth of $18 billion. ProPublica, the investigative journal, says the answer rests with IFC's desire to reduce risky loans and maximize profits to bolster its loan portfolio. In more than 100 countries around the globe, the IFC has a history of working with big corporations, including ExxonMobil, and billionaires to finance deals that would likely attract commercial funding. IFC also funds many dirty energy projects, including oil pipelines and gold and copper mines. A harsh review by the World Bank's Internal Evaluation Unit concluded that over half of IFC loans had nothing to do with fighting poverty, with only 13% of the funds dedicated to poverty reduction. On an impulse, New Orleans teenager Pershell Richardson grabbed her neighbor's iPhone and ran home. The police soon arrested the high school student on felony charges. Because her family could not afford bail, she spent the next 51 days in jail, missing weeks of school, waiting for a court date. The teenager was later released into a diversion program and was never convicted of a crime. According to the Christian Science Monitor, millions of low-income Americans sit for weeks in local and county jails because they cannot afford bail. Today, it's estimated that two-thirds of jail inmates are waiting for trials, unable to pay bail. The Pretrial Justice Institute reports that over 90% of people held in local jails never end up in prison. Most are either acquitted of their charges, given probation, or enrolled in rehabilitation programs. Brigham Young Law School professor Shima Berdaran says the overwhelming majority of people in our nation's jails are not a threat to society. Most are detained for minor offenses and simply do not have the money to get out of jail. Over the last two decades, the imposition of surety bonds by judges has increased to 70% of all cases. However, the use of bail varies widely by jurisdiction. In Greater Houston, Texas, for example, only 5% of defendants are released without bail. But in Austin, judges release over 60% of offenders without the condition of a bond. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the days just before Barack Obama took the oath of office to begin his second term as president, the U.S. launched drone strikes in Yemen that reportedly killed 15 people. The administration's escalation of America's use of unmanned aerial vehicles in its targeted killing of suspected terrorists across the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa is provoking increased opposition at home and abroad. During the inauguration ceremonies in Washington, D.C., the group Code Pink Women for Peace protested against the U.S. drone program and called on the Senate to reject President Obama's nomination of John Brennan to head the CIA. Brennan, who is currently Deputy National Security Advisor and Assistant to the President for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism, is the architect of Obama's drone program and is referred to by some as the nation's assassination czar. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, was part of her group's recent 34-member delegation of Americans that visited Pakistan in October, with the goal of witnessing firsthand the damage wrought by U.S. drone strikes there. While in Pakistan's tribal Waziristan region, delegates met with Pakistani families who have been victims of U.S. drone strikes and participated in a one-day fast in memory of the estimated 450 to 800 civilians, including 160 children, killed by U.S. drones since 2004. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, who's the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Here she explains why Code Pink and a growing number of other citizens are opposed to the nation's drone program and why she's working to defeat Barack Obama's nomination of John Brennan to head the CIA.
In the case of northern Pakistan, where we visited, and it's an area that hadn't seen Americans there for about 10 years, the people are terrorized by these drones. They're afraid to send their children to school. They're afraid to go to the markets. They're afraid to go to community gatherings like weddings and funerals. They're afraid to have the traditional jirgas, which is a gathering of the elders of the community to try to solve local disputes. It's sown a distrust in the community because people wonder, well, who is it that is providing the information to the CIA that will put people on a kill list? And so people are distrusting their neighbors. And then once there is a drone strike, there is another group related to the Taliban that comes in and kills anybody they think might have been the informants. There have been thousands and thousands of people who have fled their homes because of the drones and become refugees. So it is really disturbing the entire way of life in the areas where it's being used.
Last April, you and others protested at the Woodrow Wilson International Center when John Brennan spoke there in defense of drone warfare. What was the point you were trying to raise? And certainly this is a good time to talk about your opposition to President Obama's nomination for him to head the CIA.
In April, we did a drone summit, Scott, where we brought several hundred people into Washington from various communities, the human rights communities, women's groups, groups that work on issues of war and peace, and folks came in from Pakistan, from Yemen, and we all started talking about what was happening and what we could do. And it was right at the last day of that drone summit, in fact, the next day, coincidentally, that John Brennan was going to speak out for the first time, really, publicly, trying to justify the drones. And I got in there really just almost by accident and listened to him talk about how the Taliban were responsible for the killing of innocent people and Al-Qaeda. And I felt compelled after hearing so many stories just the day before that I should get up and speak on behalf of some of the victims that the United States has killed. And so I got to talk out about people like Tariq Aziz, who had been killed for trying to document drone strikes, or the 16-year-old Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, who is the son of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American who is a radical cleric that President Obama had put on a kill list, but several weeks later, his son was killed, a 16-year-old born in Denver. And so we were just giving some examples. But the larger question is that it has been John Brennan, who has been the CIA architect of this drone program under the Obama administration, that has led to a huge rise in the number of drones being used by the Obama administration, that went from about 50 drones being used under Bush in Pakistan to over 300 used by the Obama administration, and then pushing this program into Yemen, where we've seen a tremendous increase in the number of drone strikes. Now, the important thing to know about the drones, Scott, is that they not only kill a lot of innocent people, despite the fact that John Brennan said in 2011 that not one civilian had been killed, and then revised it later to say that it was in the single digits, but also important to know how counterproductive these drones are, because they create enemies faster than we can kill them. In fact, it's become the biggest recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And when we were in Pakistan, we were amazed to see the visceral kind of hatred of the drones, not only by people in the region they're being used, but by virtually everybody in the country, no matter what political party they were part of, no matter what their political orientation. And there was a poll that showed that 3 out of 4 Pakistanis consider the United States their enemy. So it's really important to understand that these drones are making us less safe, and that's why we're so concerned that when President Obama said he looked around to see who he could tap as head of the CIA, who is somebody that could watch out for the safety of the American people, we're saying that John Brennan is the wrong person for this job. So I'm hoping that with the education work that I am doing with my new book, but that a whole lot of people around the country are doing, and the protests that are building up around Air Force bases around this country, the civil disobedience that people are doing, the protests at the headquarters of drone manufacturers, the pressure that we're starting to put on Congress, that we're going to see a lot more people join us in questioning the drone program and calling for some rules of the game.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace and Global Exchange. She's the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Learn more about the growing opposition to the U.S. Drone Warfare Program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On January 26th, hundreds of protesters are expected to converge in Portland, Maine, for what's being billed as the largest tar sands protest in the Northeast. The impetus is what organizers say are plans to reverse the flow of an existing pipeline that currently takes oil from ships arriving in South Portland Harbor and pumps it to Montreal, Canada. Activists say the Canadian company Enbridge is now considering pumping tar sands oil from Alberta through Quebec to Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. Both Enbridge and the Portland Pipeline Corporation, which is owned by ExxonMobil, say such plans were put on hold in 2009. But the National Wildlife Federation has released documents indicating that the proposal is very much an active option. There's widespread opposition to the extraction of tar sands oil because it produces far more greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming than conventional production methods. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dylan Voorhees, Clean Energy and Global Warming Project Director with the Natural Resources Council of Maine, one of the groups that's organizing the protest, along with Environment Maine, 350.org, the National Wildlife Federation, the Natural Resources Defense Council, and other groups. Here, Voorhees explains that despite asserting they have no plans to reverse the pipeline flow, the companies have, in fact, expressed a keen interest in doing just that.
They've actually not said that they don't want to do this. In fact, what they've told public officials in a number of meetings is that they very much would like to do this. But what they are saying also in the public is that they have no plan at this time to do it, which is kind of like saying, I don't have a plan yet for dinner tonight. They admit that they would like to do it because I think the prospect of sending oil into Canada these days is a diminishing market for them. And that's what the pipeline does right now. It takes regular crude oil off of tankers that come into Portland Harbor and it flows up to Montreal. And it's been doing that for 60 years. But there's a new day in oil, and that's because of tar sands in Canada. And Canada has in the ground enormous amounts of tar sands that oil companies are trying to get out of Canada. That's the situation across Canada, and that's led to the proposals of the Keystone XL pipeline, which would go from Canada down to the Gulf. There's a project proposed for taking tar sands west to British Columbia, and this is really more of the same.
Well, Burlington, Vermont, and Casco, Maine have recently passed resolutions opposing tar sands going through their towns. What, if any, control do towns have over a pipeline going through their territory?
Very little, unfortunately. And the town of Casco, Maine, which is a small town on Sebago Lake, which is one of the larger lakes in the state and is kind of a jewel in the tourism region in southwestern Maine, Casco passed a resolution which expresses the sentiment of the town. It doesn't really have a lot of binding impact, but it says very clearly, and it was an actual vote of the townspeople at a town meeting, that they are opposed to this and they're very concerned about their economy and their environment. And I think that's what we will begin to see from more and more towns across Maine and New Hampshire and Vermont, and we've already seen a little bit in Quebec, towns saying, we don't want this. And hopefully, collectively, that sends a message. But towns don't have a lot of say, and even states may not have a lot of say. What we've been starting to say is that we are calling on the U.S. State Department to require what's called a presidential permit, and that's because the pipeline crosses an international boundary. The State Department is the one that can control permitting. We want to make sure that there will be a presidential permit required before this change happens, and that will enable us to see an environmental review happen. if that doesn't happen, then we're very concerned that this project could go forward without really environmental reviews.
Dylan Voorhees, you know, tar sands is a lot more corrosive than other kinds of oil, and this pipeline is already 60 years old. Are there concerns about spills?
There's a lot of concern in Maine about possible spills from if tar sands was moving to this pipeline. And that's because tar sands has different physical properties from regular crude oil. It's much more viscous. It's much more toxic. It's actually diluted down with very dangerous toxic chemicals. And because of the higher temperatures, higher pressures, and additional corrosiveness, acidity, and abrasives, we think that the dangers is significantly greater. What we particularly know is that tar sands pipelines in the Midwest that have been carrying tar sands for some time have had incidents of spills or leaks at three times the rate of regular oil pipelines per mile of pipeline. Secondly, the consequences of a spill of tar sands are much more damaging than regular crude oil, and that's because it's so thick and it's so heavy and it has these toxic chemicals in it. And the huge tar sand spill in the Kalamazoo River in 2010, which was an Enbridge pipeline, really demonstrated how practically impossible to clean up tar sands is if it spills.
This rally is being billed as the largest tar sands protest in the Northeast. What exactly is your goal in bringing people to Portland on January 26th?
I think the rally is meant to really try and get on the radar that this is a very serious issue and that the public, not just from Maine, but from across the region, really don't want to see this happen and are calling on elected officials, you know, first and foremost, to act on the people's behalf and really make sure, as a first order, that there's an environmental review before this happens. And that's sort of common sense, but it's not a foregone conclusion that there would even be a real permitting and environmental review process for this change.
That was Dylan Voorhees of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. Find more information on the campaigns to stop the development and transport of tar sands oil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and work this year coincided with President Obama's second inauguration on January 21st. Because Obama is America's first African-American president, King's lifelong struggle for racial equality was prominently discussed in the coverage of the day's events. But while not as much focused on by corporate media and mainstream politicians, King was also very much active in the fight against economic inequality. In fact, in his April 4, 1967 speech, "Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam," delivered exactly 1 year before his assassination, King discussed the urgent need to battle the giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation. In a new report published on this year's Martin Luther King holiday, the group United for a Fair Economy focused on King's unfinished work addressing economic disparity. Their report, titled State of the Dream 2013, A Long Way From Home, assessed the impact of the Great Recession with its string of foreclosures and crash of home values on the growing racial wealth divide. The report found that the average white family holds significantly greater wealth than the average black or Latino family, and housing wealth comprises a far greater share of total assets for black and Latino families than for their white counterparts. Your reporter spoke with Tim Sullivan, policy coordinator with United for a Fair Economy and co-author of the State of the Dream report. Here he discusses the conclusions of the report and summarizes some of the recommendations made for changes in public policy as they affect housing and strategies for building wealth in communities of color.
What we looked at specifically is how people of color, black and Latino families and white families, how they've fared since the Great Recession, and we found that there's a very disparate racial impact, which has a lot to do with where and how people hold their assets. What was really at the core of this recession that began in 2007 was a housing bubble. And the result of that is that this housing bubble burst and housing value declined dramatically. So if for families whose wealth was more connected to their housing than other assets, like, say, the stock market, their wealth declined more. The housing market has not come back the way that the stock market has. And what we found is that people of color, black families and Latino families, and people with lower levels of wealth, more of it is tied to their housing on average. You know, obviously, not everybody is a homeowner, but throughout communities, poorer communities have more of their wealth connected to their first home. And when the housing values decreased, more and more people found that they owed more against their house than it was actually worth. They were unable to sell it if they needed to access that money, which is a major problem with having wealth tied to housing to too great a degree, and ended up poorer than they were relative to families who were able to hold assets in stocks and bonds and bank accounts. And like I said, the housing market has not rebounded the same way that the stock market has. So the recovery has been very uneven, and people who hold a lot of stocks, which are wealthier people, have done, relatively speaking, well since the recovery, as it is, began in around 2010, 2009, I believe, is when the recovery technically began. But it's been very rough for people who need to sell their house or, in order to access their wealth, need to borrow against their house. It's been very tough for people who aren't homeowners as well. And we have a lot of policy supports for home ownership that has gotten people into a lot of good situations. It has had benefits for individuals, for families and communities, but it also has this drawback of, if that's where your wealth is, when the housing market as a whole goes down, you're in some fairly serious trouble.
Tim, what's the relative disparity between blacks, whites, and Latinos when it comes to family net worth?
Well, it's immense is really what it is. There's a lot of different ways to look at it, and every way that you do, it is a overwhelming disparity. For both black and Latino families, white families, on average, have about six times as much wealth. That's the average amount, and if you look at it in terms of the median, and that's the middle of the wealth distribution, it's even greater. I believe it's around 10 to 1 for white families to black families at the median. So it's really just every way that you look at it, it's a staggering, overwhelming disparity.
Well, Tim, at the conclusion of the State of the Dream 2013 report, you make some recommendations about policy changes, and maybe you can first talk about how the Obama administration, in the first 4 years, how well they've worked on housing policy, and what you would advocate for changes going forward over the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of housing policy, I think that it's on this, the second inauguration for Barack Obama, it's been very disappointing. The Obama administration came into office really when the housing crisis was beginning to full-scale epic disaster, and it really was. The level of foreclosures, the number of people losing their homes was staggering, and the programs that they put in place were frankly, insufficient. And additionally, there was banks and lending institutions that were engaged in what, frankly, was illegal activity, and the prosecution of those has been fairly weak. There have been some settlements that have come out about faulty document filing practices and people who lost their homes, who were foreclosed, who shouldn't have been, who should have had opportunities to save their home. And the settlements, like I said, have been fairly disappointing. We highlight there's a lot of groups around the country that are working very effectively on those issues at the local level, on the ground, and fighting foreclosure. We highlight one of them that's up here in Boston, City Life Vita Urbana, who are really provided kind of a model for the country of blockading and preventing foreclosure and following through the legal process towards systemic change as well. And in terms of housing, there's a complex mix of various federal laws and state laws and local laws. We focus really on the tax expenditures related to housing more than anything else. At United for a Fair Economy, we have worked on taxes since our founding in the 90s, and there's a huge benefit for home ownership in the tax code, and the distribution where that benefit goes to is not where we think it should be going to as it pertains to housing policy in particular.
That was Tim Sullivan, policy coordinator with United for a Fair Economy and co-author of the State of the Dream 2013 report. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you can find links to download a copy of the report and additional commentary. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.